On February 25th through 27th, Resurgence held our 2008 national conference titled Text and Context at Mars Hill Church's Ballard Campus in Seattle, Washington. The conference featured John Piper, Jim Gilmore, Matt Chandler, CJ Mahaney, and Mark Driscoll. We hope that you are blessed as you listen to how these godly men seek to deal faithfully with Scripture while proclaiming the truth of Scripture to the varied cultures and contexts in which they live. For more content, please visit theresurgence.com.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, despite that slam on Ohio. Let me get set up here. I don't usually have a lecture like this for the things that I do, but I'm going to take advantage of it now that I have it. Well, I am not a prophet, nor am I a prophet's son. I am but a businessman, a writer of business books. And the Lord took me from the speaking circuit of businesses and said, go speak to my people at Resurgence. And so here I am, following Mark, CJ, John Piper. What am I doing here? I'm just a business guy. You know, I guess I'm going to share some context, or I'm going to help put some context and text in context. But what am I doing here? Here's why I'm here. I am an evidence of grace. I am here because I heard about this guy, Mark Driscoll, at one of several Leadership Network events I did, but I never acted upon the information. I've enjoyed the Leadership Network events that I've done. I trust that it's been of some service to the kingdom. But I always come away just a little bit bothered by some of the applications that church folks do to our ideas that we never intended. And I just some of them are actually bothersome to me. I fear and I tremble, right, that because I pray that the work is actually used for good and not for bad. So, but about two summers ago, I think it was, two friends of mine who were here, Bill Morgan and Brett Flanagan, made a guy trip to Seattle, piggybacked onto a business trip, you know, go see a couple of Mariners games, you know, check out the city. And they came to Mars Hill Church to worship. And Brett bought a copy of Radical Reefer Mission and reading the book on his flight back home, got to chapter 3, and there's Mark treating my book, and he sees me mentioned by name, sends me an email. And so I got the email. I went, oh, yeah, I think this could be the person that Dave Travis told me about. So I Googled Mark Driscoll. That was fun. Then I read, in fact, I knew I had to get a hold of this guy when I read this interview in Christianity Today where he blasted the effeminate nature of music in megachurches. And I went, there's my man. And it just bothersome to me. So I sent an email off and said, hey, I'd love to have a chat with Mark if possible. I heard back and it was arranged. We spent an hour on the phone, had a great conversation. And one of the things I shared with Mark is my desire to find a place to serve that is both reformed and relevant. Not just relevant, and by the way, not relevant and reformed. It's text first for a reason, right? And I hope in some way that I can help today. So I think, you know, that's why I am here. So I think Mark invited me to be with you, and I'm delighted to be with you today. Now, if I can once again steal from the construct of Amos, I'm not a preacher. But I am a preacher's son. In fact, I was conceived when my father pastored a Methodist church in Center Moreland, Pennsylvania. I was born when he was a chaplain in the United States Air Force. I was born in Myrtle Beach. And while my dad went back on the GI Bill and got a degree in journalism, and he spent probably half of his life in the pastor and half in other capacities, journalism and teaching English, which he still does to this day at 79 years of age. He teaches university English. For most of my college years, and my early adulthood. My father pastored two churches in the dying coal region of Pennsylvania. And I have some real understanding, I think, of what you go through, the pressures you go through with your congregations. I remember very vividly one time on break, Christmas or spring break, going home to see my father and going with him to a visit to a nursing home to visit one of his parishioners, a woman who was in a nursing home and had Alzheimer's. And I remember watching my father endure 20 minutes of this woman railing against her pastor, not realizing that she was talking to her pastor. It was so surreal. And when we got in the elevator to leave the place, I'll never forget, I'm side by side with my dad, and we're both looking forward. And my dad turns to me and says, "Jim, don't you ever put me in a nut house like this." Some of you, I think, sometimes you feel you're in nut houses. I remember my dad talking about a particular elder, Bucky. He always would say his name, never in the church, but behind the scenes, Bucky, Bucky. He just liked saying Bucky was some release for him, Bucky. So, you know, I have some empathy for the pressures you have in your congregations, but more so, I have appreciation for the pressures you have from Scripture. I was glad that Mark cited this yesterday. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. That is an awesome responsibility. And I'm here teaching teachers. Man, that makes me fear and tremble. It really does, right? Because I have to trust at your hands to do good with this. Right? Talking about business stuff with folks who pastor churches. So that is my desire. And, you know, and I also thought about, you know, how to start my time with you. And I thought about this space. Right, I thought about the person who most occupies this space. And I thought, what better way than to start the talk than talk about a comedian? You got Driscoll, like he gets his, you know, his inspiration from preaching style from the comedians. So I want to talk about a flight that I shared in the year 2000 with George Carlin. Year 2000 was the first full year after the Experience Economy was published. I was gone 135 days. Talking with different trade shows, conferences, clients about the Experience Economy, 135 days. And this was a flight from Cleveland to Los Angeles. And that year, I was so busy on a five-hour flight like that, I'm going to prepare my presentation on the flight out. This is pre-9/11, so I prided myself on being the last person to board the plane to get to my seat. And I'm putting my things away, and I looked at who's going to be my seat partner and looked like someone who sort of looks like George Carlin. I started putting my things away, and I realized it is George Carlin. And I sit down, and multiple people come from coach. Say I'm lifetime platinum with Continental, which gets me up to first class. But what lifetime platinum really means is I'm gone from home way too much. So I have some people coming from coach, getting signatures, going over my lap and getting signatures from him. And early on in this flight, he had run out of reading material. And he got very frustrated, like he had ADD, just very antsy. And I had the Wall Street Journal, and the personal interest column, the Wall Street Journal, was a very, very funny piece, and I knew George Carlin does not read the Wall Street Journal. And there's a column about Pudding Man. And it was an article about this guy in the San Francisco Bay Area had taken to buying all these cans of pudding, because if you took the label off, every label was worth $25 on American Airlines. And he would show up at grocery stores, and they would literally, you know, announce Pudding Man is in aisle 3. And it was this hysterical article. And he had so many labels, it dawned on him that he couldn't get them all bound up and sent off in time for the deadline. So he donated them all to the Salvation Army if they would agree to put them in stacks of 100 and give them back to him. This is a hysterical piece, so I handed it to him without even looking at him. I went like this. A technique I learned from my co-author, Joe Pine, who once sat cross aisle from Howard Stern and had read a review of his book and in The Economist, and guaranteed Howard Stern does not read The Economist, and tore the book review out and just handed it cross aisle like that without looking. And then when Stern realized what it was, sort of gave a look over, said, gave him a nod like, "Hey, I belong up here too." So I did the same thing with Carl. I handed it to him. He read it. He's laughing about the article. So we're taxing out, and I never met a person who was so specific in his requirements for what he wanted on the flight. When the flight attendant came to him and me and asked what we wanted to eat, he responded, well, I'd like to have that pasta dish, but I'd like to have it at the last possible moment when I can finish consuming it before we begin our descent. In other words, he was planning to work on his Apple notebook and did not want to be disturbed by the meal. So he had thought through enough of the details. He knew very specifically what he wanted. So I knew I had to work as well on this flight to get my presentation done for the next day. So I'm busy working away the whole flight. And this whole flight, I'm thinking, well, at some point, I'm going to strike up a conversation with George Carlin. And I figure it's going to be when the pasta dish comes. So when the pasta dish comes, and he puts away his things and he gets his food, I turn to him and I said, Mr. Carlin? He said, yes. I said, I want to let you really know how much I appreciate you not interrupting me during this flight. And he lost it. And I figured, man, I got George Carlin laughing. This is really, really good. So first thing I did is I made a confession. I said, I have to make a confession, Mr. Carlin. He said, well, out with it. I said, I once came in second place in a talent show in high school playing the role of the hippy-dippy weatherman. He said, not bad for being derivative. And I said, well, I got another thing to share. I really, really appreciate your observational skills. I said, I don't think very many people are very good at observing the world around him. He said, oh, to the contrary. People observe all the time. He goes, this is why I can talk about it. You ever go to the refrigerator, you look in and you see nodding heads? Because people observe the same information. He said, the problem is they don't know where to put the data. And then he shared with me that he has 2,500 different directories in his notebook, categories by which he records his daily observations, 2,500 different categories, and he knows those 2,500 categories. Well, today I believe my role here is to help you with where to put the data. I largely see that as my role. But before we get into that, given I've just talked about George Carlin, this avowed atheist, right, who just vehemently shares his atheism, what greater thing can we do than have 1,300 pastors and church planters pray for George Carlin and his ilk? All right? So I'm going to ask if you would bow your heads in silent prayer. So we have all these prayer warriors, then I'll say a brief word of prayer to conclude, and then we'll get on with the show. Father Almighty, great Lord of hosts, you touch the earth and it melts. You are being, and yet there are those today who deny you by saying that you do not even exist. Whether they're philosophical atheists like George Carlin, or they're practical atheists who live as if there were no God, we would ask that you reach out in your grace and providence to those who are your children and fill them with restlessness. Let them feel isolated, alone, and let them know that their loneliness and isolation is a result of the fact that there is a God who is there. And Lord, grant them no peace until they turn through your hand to the Prince of Peace, in whose name we pray. Amen. I'd like to talk about technology. I'd like to talk about technology that's the most telling technology of our times, a technology that most informs us about what it is that people desire today. Anybody have any nominations for this technology? This is the participatory portion of the show. What technology most informs us? It's iconic for what people want today. Cell phone would be a good nomination. Not what I have in mind. What's particularly interesting about the cell phone is that we live in an age where people pay for ringtones. How the phone sounds. It's incredible. Great nominee, not what I have in mind. What else? iPod, another great nominee. I'm going to talk about iPod a little bit tomorrow, about what we've done with this good, the experiences it enables. Good nominee. All these handheld devices would be good nominees. What else? Internet, very good nominee. Actually, not the internet, because the internet's been around for decades. Right? I forget the exact year that Al Gore invented the internet. It's actually not the internet, but the World Wide Web, right, that Tim Berners-Lee layered on top of this decades-old technology, the internet, because HTML programming language allowed us to see things and hear things. And some high-tech applications actually touch things virtually and at a distance, even smell things and taste things. They're working on that. Good nominee. Actually, all those are good ideas, but I actually had in mind this device. Have you seen them? It's called a Gumball Wizard. It's invented by a company in Arizona called Global Gumball. Now, think about this device. There is no traditional, functional reason for this. It's not a better gumball. In fact, it's the exact same gumball. It's the exact same physical good. It's not a better service. Arguably, it's a worse service. It takes you longer for you to get your order after you've placed it. Right? This is not about the features and benefits of the goods and services. Rather, it's about the gumball spiraling experience that's wrapped around that traditional offering. And it's iconic for what is happening in industry after industry. Some of these devices have actually become quite elaborate. Perhaps you've seen them. They're almost like a roller coaster for the gumball. Put your quarter in, watch the gumball go around and around and around. Bells and whistles and lights go off. A few years ago, I saw a couple of not quite teenagers putting quarters into one of these devices at a Walmart, watching it go around and around and around, and then not consuming the gum after it came out. Now, what were they buying? They were buying the experience explicitly. They still got the gumball, but the gumball was subsumed inside of the experience. They still got the service, the delivery service, but it was subsumed inside of the experience. And I will argue that in this industry, all of the demand for a gumball is a function of the layering on of this experience on top of the traditional offering. And it's iconic for the foundational model that my co-author and business partner Joe Pine and I call the progression of economic value. You're going to have to endure a little bit of economic history with me this morning. For some of you who took undergraduate economics, you might cringe at this very thought. I understand if you want to take a few moments and step outside and skip this portion, I understand. But it is foundational to my perspective. So let's go back, if you will, with me, 200 years or more, to the agrarian economy, when the extracting of commodities or natural stuff became the basis of the agrarian economy. Nearly everybody lived or worked on farms extracting commodities. But we automated that work. Those jobs went away. And people left the farm to go into the factory, and the making of goods or tangible things became the basis of the industrial economy. Eventually, a majority of people worked in manufacturing. Eventually, a majority of economic output was in physical things. It surpassed the output of commodities. But then we automated that work. Manufacturing jobs went away, and people left the factory to go into the service sector, and the delivery of services or intangible activities became the basis of the service economy. It was actually in the 1950s when, for the first time in this country, a majority of people worked in services. Today, well over 50% of gross domestic product is in services. And a classic distinction, by the way, between goods and services: goods are tangible, services are intangible. There's an old economist joke. I'm an economist by training. And by the way, it doesn't get much better than this for economists in terms of humor. Economists will say, if you take an economic offering, and if you drop it on your foot, if it hurts, it's a good. If it doesn't hurt, it's a service. Right? They speak of the line of tangibility to differentiate a good from a service. Well, today we're automating service jobs. Services are going away with the full force that we previously automated through the forces of technology and productivity, that we previously automated goods and agrarian employment. And people are leaving the service sector and are being employed in the staging of experiences or memorable events. Experiences are not a subset, a subclassification of services. Experiences are as distinct in kind from services as services are from goods. And we can speak of the line of memorability to differentiate an experience from a mere service. And it's our bold contention in our book, The Experience Economy, that these paid-for, memorable events are the basis of an emerging experience economy. That we are finding ways to commodify time, whether it's an admission fee to a theme park or a movie, or whether it's your Netflix subscription or your timeshare for handbags, my most recent favorite that's getting a lot of publicity. Right? We're finding ways to charge for the time for people using goods and services. So this is the foundational model of our work. I'm going to be hanging a lot on this model. But this is the theoretical construction, so let's go through some specific industry examples. And the first industry I'd like to look at, because we're here in Seattle, is the coffee industry. We could check today's Wall Street Journal for the commodity price of coffee. This is green coffee, unroasted coffee beans in burlap bags on pallets, say in the port of Seattle. I suspect it's actually the port of Tacoma, right? It's trades for about 3 or 4 cents a cup. That's by the commodity coffee. But if you take that commodity coffee and you roast it and you grind it and you package it, say as Maxwell House in a can, that cup of coffee sells for 5 to 10 cents a cup. Buy the physical goods processed at a factory, make the coffee yourself 5 or 10 cents a cup. But take that coffee and brew it on behalf of another. That's a coffee-making service. Anytime a company performs the activity that people used to do for themselves, that's a service. That cup of coffee sells for maybe 50 cents to a dollar at a local restaurant, diner, McDonald's. But take that coffee, technically a different bean, the Arabica bean that costs 4 or 5 cents a cup at a commodity level, and provide a place for a coffee-drinking experience. And how much do some of you sneak out every day and pay for your cup of coffee? All right, $3, $4, I think you can push almost $5 a cup at Starbucks if you get some kind of white mocha fufu venti coffee of some crazy sort that people willingly pay. Now think about Starbucks. We'll touch upon them a little bit more. Think about the amount of square footage they devote to commodities. At best, a little tray full of raw coffee beans. Think about the square footage they devote to physical goods for mugs and bags of coffee. Footprint of a few places. Think about the area they have for services, the actual preparation of the coffee, all the area behind the space, or behind the counter. But the vast majority of space at Starbucks is providing a place to spend time, the currency of experiences, a place to spend time drinking a cup of coffee. And this progression of economic value in the business world, by the way, has become iconic for this progression of economic value of what's happening in the economy. A few years ago, Business Week used our framework in their innovation issue to as a way of graphically depicting the rewards of innovation. Right, so this is now widely known. The experience economy is in 14 languages. Over 135,000 copies have sold in English. Probably well over 200,000 copies have sold worldwide, not counting the counterfeit paperback edition that's available in China. And it is. Joe was over there and discovered it. But I want to talk for a moment about Starbucks and make my feeble effort at application for the church. A couple things about Starbucks. First, it's great evidence of coveting. Saw a bumper sticker in California a few years ago. Friends don't let friends drink at Starbucks. It's the folks who think Starbucks coming in town is going to wreck the town, right? Because they covet their success. It's coveting. right? We should bless their success. Here's some very interesting facts to share with the crowd who thinks Starbucks comes to town and ruins it for all the other coffee shops. In 1986, the first year for which the Specialty Coffee Association for America has statistics, there were less than 500 coffee shops or cafes in the United States, and none of them were Starbucks. And while Starbucks has grown, you know, over 10,000 outlets, simultaneously, right, a nearly equal number of cafes have opened. Starbucks has helped change the entire pattern of consumption, right? And the industry that's been most hurt by this is office coffee. When I started at Procter & Gamble in 1981, I remember pitching in $10 a month for a coffee pool to get this really awful coffee in a white styrofoam cup. Gone, right? Gone. The whole pattern of consumption has changed. Very interesting to me, Starbucks culturally. In fact, I believe to some extent we can see today that the church mirrors the rise of Starbucks. And that a Starbucks is no community. Right now, I don't buy into the whole Putman Bowling Alone book. I think he romanticizes a past that's never there. But I think that we can talk about community. I mean, I think more people are actually bowling today, and we are inventing new kinds of sports in the experience economy that people are participating in. But at Starbucks, it is not a community. It is a collection of individuals. And I'm afraid, my friends, that to some extent, contemporary Christianity is the same thing. It's true corporately, where we have multiple churches in the same city, and quite frankly, they are I am of Paul and I am of Apollos. They haven't even met each other. It's a collection of individual churches. And inside those churches, to some extent, it's a collection of individuals. And we're a reflection of our culture, right, as opposed to something that stands apart from culture. We ought to be the place that alone people can experience true community among the sainthood of believers. Right? Opening up the coffee shops, right? It's just such a too easy way to go learn from culture, as opposed to look at what's really going on. Is this, in fact, Howard Schultz uses the phrase third place without properly attributing it to Ray Oldenburg, who in this wonderful book, The Great Good Place, talks about ever since we decoupled work from the home, it created the desire for a third place, not home, not work, a place to go and just hang out. And Starbucks has stepped in with the decline of bars after work as a place to go and stepped in and has provided that third place to really just be alone, maybe with a small group of friends on occasion, but basically be alone. Let's do another progression of economic value. It's the birthday progression of economic value. When I was a little boy, I remember very distinctly my mother would make my birthday cake from scratch. Now, what does it mean to make a birthday cake from scratch? A lot of you don't even know, right? Because of the 6 out of 7 here are male and also the age, right? It means making the cake from actual commodities, flour, sugar, eggs, cocoa. My mother would actually touch commodities. This is bizarre human behavior in the 21st century. And she might spend 10 or 20 cents, right, pick some constant dollars for these commodities. But in the 70s, my mom, like many others, stopped making the cake from scratch. She would instead go to the grocery store, and she would buy a cake mix for $1 or $2 and make the cake from that packaged good manufactured at the factory. By the way, for some moms, this made for a worse cake, but for others, this was a vast improvement in quality to make the shift. It was worth the $2. In the 80s, parents really stopped making the cake from the physical goods. They would instead call the grocery store, call the local bakery, have a cake made on their behalf, a cake-making service. And how much would you pay for a cake-making service? Maybe $10 or $20, another order of magnitude price point for the service. Then, of course, in the 90s, parents not only outsourced the making of the cake, they outsourced the entire birthday party to a Chuck E. Cheese, Discovery Zone, celebrations, local pottery studio, bowling alley, ad nauseum outlets for birthdays. And how much do parents willingly pay for these birthday party experiences? hundreds of dollars. Some of you who are young enough, you were reared in a Chuck E. Cheese era of birthdays. You don't know it any other way. Right? That's why some of the music resembles little animatronic guys up here doing this little kind of thing. All right. Actually, if you get authenticity, we have a whole little bar game we invented where you can define any contemporary musical artist by the combination of two previous artists. It's a fun game. I'll let you go skim the book out there. But I've been to churches where Chuck E. Cheese meets Dave Matthews. I could go on and on, but I just can't do it. Here's the point I want to make about Chuck E. Cheese. If you were here for worship on one of the services on Sunday, Mark talked about the importance of the city, right? It is a city where culture is bred. And he rattled off a number of cities, Seattle, Minneapolis, South Beach. You can see the bias here, very hip cities. He left out one city, right? I believe Chuck E. Cheese is wonderful evidence that the epicenter of the experience economy is Las Vegas. Everything, it's the epicenter of the experience economy, and everything that is happening in Las Vegas is coming soon to your town. Have you ever thought about how remarkable or how Vegas-like it is for little kids to be walking around with coins in a plastic cup? It's so Vegas. Old Vegas, right? You have to go to Fremont Street Experience to still get that kind of coins and cup things. ESPN Zone, it's a sports book. Hooters, cocktail waitresses. Where I went to the Lakers Sonics game on Sunday night. You know, the dancing squads, Vegas. The screens, Vegas. Everything in Las Vegas is coming to your town. It's the epicenter of the experience economy. Now, hearing Mark talk, I thought, well, maybe it's more the epicenter of what gets exported to suburbia and exurbia. I'd listen to that argument. In fact, that the Seattles and Minneapolises and Nashvilles and South Beach are what is influencing the cities. But I still think Las Vegas permeates society in ways that in many multiplicity of ways that if you study it, you'll see it. One last progression of economic value. Both coffee and birthday, we've published. This is a progression of economic value that has not been published. And it didn't come to me until I was talking to a dear woman, a very godly woman, Kathy Stottenbauer, at our church, who shared with me that their family raises their own chickens. This is really bizarre behavior in the 21st century. How many of you here still raise your own chickens? Show of hands. We've got one, we've got two. You all went to Washington State? That's for Driscoll back here. All right, he cuts on Ohio. I got to slam back a little bit. Anyway, she shared with me that for like $1.20 a chick, they order chicks mail order from McMurray Hatchery. There's actually subsidized U.S. postal rates in order to get the chicks to be delivered overnight without dying. Right? It's still there. Most of us, of course, don't buy chicken at a commodity level for like $1.25 a chicken, raise them. By the way, the Sottenbauer family still hires an Amish family to butcher the chickens. Thank you very much. But I remember hearing stories of my dad in the 1920s, 1930s raising his own chickens. In fact, every family in their whole little town raised their own chickens. Right? That's how things have changed. Right? Now, we might go to the grocery store and we might buy some Tyson chicken, some processed chicken, very rudimentary form of manufacturing. Might pay a couple bucks a pound, depending on whether it's boneless or non-boneless. What's the chicken-making service? Right? KFC? You might pay $1 or $2 a piece at KFC, or I have to, of course, insert Chick-fil-A on top of them. Yeah. Right? Love this company, client of mine. And they have a... that's not why I love them, by the way. No. Okay. What's the plan? Here's why I love them. I did a learning excursion, something we do, top 50 executives of Chick-fil-A in New York City. They left the office not even knowing what city they were going to. That's how disruptive we wanted to make their model. So you can call your family on the way. We'll tell you on the bus ride. They land in New York City. The first thing they do once they check in is load a bus to go see Blue Man Group. because Blue Man Group, of course, is a great application if you work at Chick-fil-A. Learn a lot from this. And we're waiting on the board of bus, and we're delayed because the president, Dan Cathy, is outside. And I witnessed this firsthand. A homeless person had come up to him, and I never saw an interaction with a homeless person in my life like Dan Cathy, the president and CEO of Chick-fil-A. He went up, and he introduced himself, and he shook his hand, said, "Hi, I'm Dan Cathy. What's your name?" Touched him. Man, powerful. "Where are you from? You know, how'd you end up here?" Buses waiting, showing genuine concern for this one human being. Right? When he's all done, said, "Let me tell you, I'll tell you where the nearest Chick-fil-A is. Here's a couple of cards, and you can go get a free sandwich. By the way, if you need some help, let the manager know there. If you don't need any help getting food or lodging, we'll help you out." Right? Man, it's just a great testimony of the love of Christ and the CEO, and it exudes the entire organization. It's a great company. Right? It's a great company. Won't even get into the Sunday thing with them. The main point here is you can differentiate a service. Right? I think this is a superior chicken-making service than Kentucky F chicken. Right? I wonder if I could get away with that one with this crowd. I guess I guessed right. I've done that with deathly silence and respondents over. They actually have a foot in the experience business. Every time Chick-fil-A opens a new outlet, they give the first 100 customers free chicken for a year. They camp out. Like the olden days for rock concerts, they had to set a 24-hour limit before you could first set up camp. Dan Cathy goes to as many of them as possible. Probably over 100 store openings. He camps overnight on site with raving fans. He views it as part of his job responsibility to spend that time with his raving fans. There's a model to be learned from that. Right? The bigger, more successful you get, the idol of success, right? Does it detach you from talking to the people who are raising their own chickens? They're in your congregation. They're here, right? Right? Great company. Now, let's get to experiences, though. What's the chicken experience? What's the chicken experience where people spend $45 for a single chicken breast? Been to this place? Medieval times. It's like the gumball machine of chicken breast. They wrap a night jousting festival around the chicken. Right? You go in, they give you a flag for the color. You know, I went in with white and red. I'm cheering for white and red with my kids and my family. By the way, lower cost food service. This is, after all, medieval times, so there's no silverware. Right? No silverware shrinkage. Like the wenches go by and pour your soft drink or beer. Very low delivery costs. But they certainly pay some money for the experience that they layer on top of it. Been around for nearly 3 decades, highly successful experience staging business in the chicken industry. Right? Now, what to make of medieval times? Well, we live in a time where people think because we have places that are staging medieval times, that we live in postmodern times. Right? A good iconic thing of postmodernism. But, you know, I don't think this is all that different. In fact, I'm going to go on a little attack on using the term postmodernism, because it's really not that different. If you think about medieval times, guys strapping on their gears and hopping on a horse, we have that today. It's guys strapping on their gear and hopping on their hog. We are so often so concerned, like those in Acts 17, about what's new. But it takes on the form of the interest in what's next, right? I think your responsibility is not to focus on what's next, what's new, what's emerging, but that which is constant and unchanging. If you want to understand culture, understand the culture. And here's, by the way, I'll give you my business person's definition of culture that I picked up on a consulting project with Kellogg's in the late 1980s. Culture is that set of behavior that remains the same even after you have 100% turnover in the people. Culture is that set of behavior that endures even when you've had 100% turnover in the people. Well, if we go all the way back to Genesis and the fall, your concern should be about that set of behavior that's unchanging. It's the culture of sin. There is nothing new about that. It just manifests itself differently. Just like I believe the desire to hop on some beast and put on the equipment, it just manifests itself differently in different times. Nothing really new about that. Okay? Yet we're so enamored with postmodernism. Wonderful book. I enjoyed it. Craig Detweiler and Barry Taylor. Detweiler is at Biola and Taylor is at Fuller Seminary. I make it a point, by the way, every time I'm in Southern California, if I can, to swing by Fuller Seminary and go to the bookstore, because I love to check out what they're having the seminary students read. And that's where I found this book, The Matrix of Meaning, Finding God in Pop Culture. Wonderful book. I enjoyed it. I particularly like this quote, where they say, we actually draw a distinction between postmodernism and postmodernity. Postmodernism comprises the theory, the philosophical views about the subject, and is for all intents and purposes dead in the water. There's already talk among academic circles of postmodernism, the implication being that postmodernism is passé, so forth and so forth and so on. And then they say this. But postmodernity is alive and kicking. It is the culture, the way of life, that rolls along with barely an acknowledgement of the theory that supposedly birthed it. Supposedly. I don't think it's a useful term at all. They, in this book, outline 10, I believe it's 10 different trends that they then blow out into this matrix of meaning in pop culture. It's a very interesting analysis. But all the terms they use, post-national, post-rational, post-literate, post-scientific technical, post-sexual, post-racial, post-human, post-dramatic therapeutic, post-ethical institutional, and post-Christian, if you read what they actually say in each one of these sections, post is not the right prefix. It's multinational. It's irrational. Thank goodness for the talks we had yesterday. Right? Why do you believe this? What is the reason for the faith that you have? Right? It's irrational. We throw out our chance to talk about the faith if we simply tell people that we're in a post-rational time. Post-literate, they're illiterate. They're illiterate. They need to read the word. Don't buy in too quickly to the need for video and film. Omnitechnical, hypersexual. How far do you have to go from Mars Hill Church to see an outlet selling hypersexual material? One block. One block. And the lingerie, DVDs, and novelties. One block. Despite National Review having a cover story on Obama, calling him the first post-racial candidate, interracial, much more useful. What's actually happening? It's inhuman. It's inhuman to say that we're in a post-human time. Anti-therapeutic, I want to get into these, amoral, quasi-Christian or pseudo-Christian. Not post-Christian. In fact, the influence of Christianity is still strong today. It's why we have a fire department. That's the influence of Christianity on our culture that's enduring. I do not want to give up too quickly calling this a post-Christian culture. It might be quasi-Christian and pseudo-Christian, right? I want to point you to a wonderful philosophical work, Sir Francis Bacon. My S Corp is named Organon Inc. after his historic work. And Bacon once wrote about what he called the four idols of the mind. I encourage you to seek it out. He writes about the four different ways in which people, humans, think falsely. And one of those idols is what he calls, ironically, the idol of the marketplace. He uses that term because he writes how certain terms gain currency in the marketplace. And what the idol of the marketplace is this. Bacon writes that we, as a fallen creatures, have the ability to make up terms for concepts that have no being. George Carlin would say that the term God is an idol of the marketplace. John Piper certainly last night told us, rightly, that evolution is the idol of the marketplace. creating a term for concepts that have no being. I think this is what postmodernism is. We have this concept that I think stands in the way of seeing more deeply and more insightfully about the detail about how actual behaviors are manifested differently. Right? And I actually think, if I may suggest quite as humbly as I can, that our framework might provide a much more useful construct for understanding what's happening in the world. Let me share with you the origins of this model. My co-author, Joe Pine, wrote a book in 1993 called Mass Customization. And Joe is fond of saying that if you customize a good, you automatically turn that good into a service. Think Dell Computer, until at least recently. Dell exhibits all the characteristics of a service company. They don't make physical goods and place them in the inventory and wait for somebody to come along and buy it at CompUSA. They have historically made computers only in response to actual orders. They are a computer-making service. Similarly, if you customize a service, you automatically turn that service into an experience. And once we saw this heuristic, in fact, Joe was teaching an executive education class making this point at IBM, and a hand shot up and said, well, you're telling us to customize services. If we customize that service, what do you automatically turn it into? And Joe said, an experience. I'll never forget, he called me that night. He said, Jim, guess what I said today? Let's go figure out what it means. True story. Once we saw the heuristic, customize a good, automatically turn a good into a service. Customize a service, automatically turn a service into an experience. We asked ourselves, what happens if you customize an experience? If you so highly customize an experience that's exactly what somebody needs, what do you automatically turn an experience into? Have you heard the phrase, a life-transforming experience? We think transformations are a fifth, indeed a final, economic offering. We think there are five and only five things that can be bought and sold in commerce. It's why in our book, Authenticity, we've renamed this model our economic theory of everything, to borrow a phrase from physics. Let me explain why. You can buy and sell materials, stuff taken from the ground. You can buy and sell things made by humans. You can sell activities performed on behalf of others. You can commodify time. And with transformations, it's the buying and selling of change. I believe if markets are allowed to be free, that every dimension of self will have change for sale. It's certainly happening physiologically with cosmetic surgery. Every dimension of self will have change for sale. That's where I believe we are headed. And I've got to share with you here, this will be a good point to do it, that rather than take this model and say, how can we use this to change our practices in the church, remember, most of you should not be teachers, my brothers, right? I might just say, some of you here are thinking about the pastorate, in the pastorate, perhaps not called to the pastorate, because most of us should not be teachers. The world is changing in terms of we are starting to see commerce shift to the charging for how people spend time and paying for personal change. I'd like to see more Christians enter the marketplace daily and reason with those who are there and start forming businesses. I am influenced here strongly by Abraham Kuyper and the idea of spheres of sovereignty. I'll touch back into this in a moment. Right? I hate seeing the church become a business. This is not your business if you charge for it. It's a byproduct at best. Because this model, in my view, begs the question, this is how we get to fifth and final economic offering, what do you get when you customize a transformation? Our answer, and if you read this in the epilogue of the experience economy, our answer is perfection. And we write in that business book, that is not the providence of man. And we end the book, a business book, quoting Ephesians 2, 8 to 10. For grace are you saved through faith. It is a gift of God, not of yourself, lest any man should boast. You are his workmanship. fact, the day will come, I believe, when everything will be for sale. And some, indeed it's happening already, will try to sell you for a fee perfection. Our advice is watch your wallet to the normal people I talk to, but to you all, don't get sucked into this. We're completely other than this activity. Right? Transformation is at best a byproduct. Address the issue of sin and salvation from it. In fact, I want to emphasize this by talking about a point of view about money. More important than understanding postmodernism, I believe, is to understand the nature of money. A dollar is a unit of human effort. You expend some work, some labor, and you get in return for that a dollar that represents your effort. And you might store them up. And then you trade them with somebody else in exchange for the output of their effort. And what is going on in the world, I believe, is a very interesting twist on what economists call the law of comparative advantage. This is a concept first articulated by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, but given a name, the law of comparative advantage, by another great dead white guy, David Ricardo. You're not only going to get Calvin and, you know, Jonathan Edwards when you come to Resurgence, you're going to get dead economists too, at least when I'm up here on stage. All right? Here's the law of comparative advantages. What Smith wrote about in The Wealth of Nations in 1776 and Ricardo codified later is that they said that the wealth of nations is maximized if they are free to specialize in what they do best and then trade with other nations for what they do best. It's the foundation of free trade. But what is happening today with the emergence, with the atomization and the individualization of expression and of demand, the fact that we have cell phones, personal computers, nanotechnology, is that law of comparative advantage is now happening at an individual by individual basis. They're specializing in what they do best, right? And paying somebody else to raise their chickens, brew their coffee, cut their hair, change their oil, mow their lawn. And increasingly, as they shift the services and experiences and the transformations, they're using all the things they acquire to help fashion personal identity. That's what's happening. I'll talk about this tomorrow in my session tomorrow when I talk about authenticity. Right? So let me tidy this all up. Another way of talking about this progression of economic value is this wonderful quote from James Brian Quinn, who teaches at Tuck Business School at Dartmouth. He wrote once that goods are the physical embodiment of the services they deliver. Great definition. So we took that, and we sort of layered on a definition at each level of the progression of economic value. We say that commodities are only the raw materials for the goods they make. Goods are only the physical embodiment for the services they deliver. Services are only intangible operations for the experiences they stage. Experiences are only memorable events for the transformations they guide. They're the platform. All the experiences that people have affect them, change them. But eventually, those transformations will be charged for explicitly. Transformations are only the temporal states for the eternalities they glorify. You can't write that, by the way, unless you know your Westminster Confession. It's there in this business book, right? I would rather than have you appropriate the experience economy thinking for staging better experiences in your churches, I'd rather have you use this framework to challenge the people who come to you and ask them where you work, the business that you own, who or what does it glorify? We may have Christians working for organizations, you're either serving him or not. Right? What does it glorify? And we ought to be participating more in starting the enterprises that stage experiences and guide transformations. Because many of you should not become teachers, my brothers. And I hope my rest of my time, I got another half an hour here, that the rest of what I'm going to do is going to be for God's glory. That's my intent. I'm going to share just one additional model here. But I hope you come away with this notion, right? Do not become a business, right? That said, I do want to share what is my favorite model from the experience economy, what we call the four realms of an engaging experience. And it's the model that we developed to address the issue, why is it that some experiences are more compelling than others? Why is it that some experiences are more compelling than others? So let me set it up, and I give it to you to use as you rightfully think it ought to be applied. Let me set up the model. First, the horizontal axis is what we call the participation axis. Are the guests or those who are participating in the experience actively participating in the experience, or are they passively participating in the experience? That's pretty straightforward, active, passive. The vertical axis is what we call the relationships axis. What is the relationship that guests have with the experience? Are they absorbing the experience from a distance, or is it more immersive where they descend into the experience? Absorb, immerse. If you go to the Grand Canyon and simply stand at the edge and look at it, that's more absorption. If you descend into the Grand Canyon, that would be more immersive. With these two axes, we can now define four different experiential realms. First, upper left. Passive absorption is a way of defining the entertainment realm. That is, it is our belief that compelling experiences are fun and enjoyable. They entertain. Now, that's not the entirety of why it's compelling. I'm not talking about entertaining folks. I'm talking about engaging them. In order to engage them, a component is entertainment. But we add to that active absorption, which is a way of defining the educational realm. Those of you writing down educational right now, in whatever modest way through your note-taking, are actually making this more educational than those of you merely waiting for my next bad joke. Right? I mean, it's rudimentary, but it's true. Your active listeners, note-takers, it makes it more educational. I can pause for a moment and talk about the educational system. The classroom professes to be educational, but is largely designed for passive absorption. The teacher can conjugate the verb or do the math problem up on the board, but it's not until the student does her or his actual work that the learning occurs. Right? It's the doing, the act of doing it. That's the educational part. Active immersion is a way of defining the escapist realm. That is to be transported from one sense of reality to another, from to. And then finally, passive immersion is a way of defining the aesthetic realm. Aesthetic with an E for a couple reasons, not aesthetic with an A. First of all, if it was aesthetic with an A, I would not be able to call this our 4E model, which I want to do. But more seriously, aesthetic with an A is the philosophical term for beauty, making things beautiful. I'm not talking about making things beautiful. Aesthetic with an E is the architectural term for the value of just being there. It's what Starbucks has tapped into, the hangout value, the value of just being there. I got this term from this wonderful essay book written by Michael Benedict, teaches architecture at the University of Texas. The book is called For an Architecture of Reality. For an Architecture of Reality. And Michael Benedict has his model for why it is that you walk into certain places and you can't wait to leave versus those places where you enter and you'd like to spend more time there. What he calls openness one, openness two, presence, and materiality. It's his model for how this value, lower left, is created. It's our contention that the most compelling experiences do not reside in any one realm, but rather richly draw from all four realms. They hit the sweet spot right in the center. They blur the distinction between active and passive. They blur the distinction between absorbed and immersed. Or you're doing different realms at different moments in time. But it's our belief that examine any human experience, and they engage because all four are present. Don't plot experiences on here. You could score it. You could get a very low score in some realms, which is why it's not compelling and not engaging. But that is the basic model. Now, let me share an example to illustrate the model, and then we'll talk about some applications. Come with me, if you will, to this wonderful flower experience in the Netherlands called Kirkenhof. It's in the town of Lisse. Here's a picture I took some Aprils ago of the fields and fields of tulips, but not just the tulips. some 16,000 different varieties of flowers. 16,000 different varieties of flowers. It's just a great place to go and be with the flowers. It is. Now, back to the model. Which realm would you say it is predominantly? Aesthetic, right? Be with the flowers. But not just the obvious, not just the flowers, all of the landscaping. Notice the two-tone grass, the three different materials used for the walking surface. Those three materials don't meet at a hard edge, but rather one wraps around the corner, the other one comes in at an angle. The Dutch have so meticulously manicured this place, it's just a great place to be and behold. Good, high aesthetic value. Now, while you're there, it's inherently escapist. It's called walking. But walking is not richly escapist, so they have every once in a while a couple of intentionally placed escapist elements. For example, this maze, this 8-foot-high shrub, you see this couple going in, there's a fort in the center, you get immersed in the maze, activity breaks out, people run into other people, oh, don't go that way, it's a dead end, don't go this way. Somebody makes it to the fort and can look down and start shouting out instructions. This is an escapist element. They have 5 or 6 of these very intentionally placed escapist elements for the experience. It seems like you encounter it at just the right time. Educationally, all the flowers are marked. You see many people taking notes. They want to learn about the different varieties of flowers, perhaps to buy the seeds or the bulbs in the gift shop later. Entertainment-wise, every once in a while, a little combo band, or my favorite entertainment element, the self-hosted water show. It's about a 150-seat pavilion. The water is synchronized to the music. It actually cues you the show's about to begin. You're tired of learning about flowers, the escapist fair, being there, you just want to sit down and be entertained for a 15-minute show. To me, this is a place that I've encountered that greatly exemplifies hitting the sweet spot. Why? Because it so richly draws from all four realms. Now, here's how we encourage folks to use the model. And that is to ask yourself 4 basic questions. First, what can be done to make the experience more fun and enjoyable? 2, what do you want guests, visitors to learn from exploring new activities? What do you want them to learn from exploring new activities? Escapist, how can you provide a sense of being transported from one sense of reality to another, from here to there? And then finally, how can you make the experience a great one just to hang out and be? We can reduce this down to 4 words: enjoy, learn, go, be. Now, before you take this model and go apply it here and there and everywhere to your church, in fact, the last place to apply it to, I'm going to argue, is worship. Sunday school lessons, retreats, and so forth, I'm all for that. But before you go applying it here and there and everywhere, I'd like to share with you how this model was conceived. This model came to me in a flash, in a moment, when I was contemplating the sacraments. Take, eat, active absorption. Baptism, particularly infant baptism, passive immersion. Parallelism here to Passover and circumcision. No infant walks up, right, to be baptized. They have nothing to do with it. To me, it solidifies my own view on infant baptism. But by the way, we all have this in common in terms of immersion. In fact, those of you who are baptistic, and I was believer's baptism when I was a young man, you sort of stolen the term immersion, right? Because it's really submersionists. Submersion. We're all immersionists, right? We all share that. We're immersed, okay? And it's passive immersion. I believe it should be a sign of that. So before you do anything else, I think you're remiss if you do not serve the Lord's Supper as an element of worship in every time you worship. I believe that wholeheartedly, right? That's the first thing to do. Right? Rather than take this model and say, how can we have a better worship experience using the 4 E's? First thing to do is take the very experience from which the whole model was derived. Right? I'd like to share with you what I call the mathematics of the Lord's Supper. by serving it every week. It dawned on me that I grew up, my dad, when he had a charge of four Methodist churches, we didn't go every week. I went to the Baptist church in town, serving the Lord's Supper once a month. You know, by the time my son was 4 years old, going to a church that serves the Lord's Supper every week, he heard the fencing of the table as many times as it took me to hear until I was 18 years of age. His ear gate heard our pastor say, "This table is for those of you who have placed your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, who have membered yourself with an evangelical church, one that proclaims the gospel of Jesus. And if you're in good standing of that church, this table is not for you if you have not placed your faith in Jesus Christ, if you have not membered yourself with an evangelical church, one that proclaims the gospel. If you are not in good standing, my friend, if that describes you, this is a time instead for you to contemplate what is it that prohibits you from coming to the table. The Lord's Supper is the proclamation of the gospel in visible, tangible form. And I'd hate to see the 4E model used to enhance the Lord's Supper. In fact, personal preference, and I'll only describe it, that I came on a little bit stronger once the Leadership Network thing was hissed. The only time I was ever hissed, by the way, by laying on a little song. But so I'll just couch this as a preference. Stop playing the music over the Lord's Supper. Because I want to hear the crunch of the bread when I have to digest it. A sound that God gave to bread. I have to crunch it. I can't help but be moved to tears whenever the bread is in my mouth. That's a sensory experience. We cannot enhance that. At least that's my own view. All right? Baptism, right? I'm glad for Mark's remarks about what is a church, right? This is a mark of the church, right? And we equally should be emphasizing that and practicing that in order to be a true church. Let's do some other things with this model. It struck me one time I was reading the Psalms, this verse. And this is my very feeble attempt to be a red-letter Christian, to call out four words. One thing I have asked of the Lord, and that I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. Back to the four E's, what I might call the heavenly realms. Seek, dwell, gaze, inquire. That's heaven. One thing I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord. Gaze upon his beauty. Can it get more fun and enjoyable than that? And to inquire in his temple, to be fully known and to know. Now, I even have some evangelical questions. Do you know the Lord? Upper right. Are you free from the bondage of sin? That's a great evangelistic escapist question. Will you be in heaven? Will you enjoy him forever? To me, it just confirms the four realms. Another thing I've done with the model, excuse me for the very crude nature of this slide because I do my own PowerPoint, and it doesn't get much cruder than this. It's not very good visually. But I'm very intrigued with the notion of the four E's over time. Right, moment to moment, where does their experience reside in those four realms? And it wasn't too long ago, I've been long familiar with Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, a tough name there. Csikszentmihalyi is his work on flow from his book, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. If you're not familiar with Csikszentmihalyi, an unbelievable following, folks write about this notion of flow, of optimal experience, a very good work. But then I also was reading Richard Steele's The Religious Tradesman, right, centuries before. And I want to show the parallelism between this more contemporary idea of flow and an older notion of calling. Let me show you Csikszentmihalyi's model of flow. He basically takes challenge versus skill and draws a line down the middle and basically says if challenge is greater than skills, that's a way of defining anxiety. The challenge is greater than your skills. If your skills is greater than your challenge, that's a way of defining boredom. But flow, optimal experience is when the two aren't in balance. That's when you lose a sense of time, right? Because the skills are suitable for the challenge. Then we layer Steele's words on top of this. What he calls employments. These are, again, old-fashioned words. Capabilities. But it's the same two ideas. He talks about discouragement and then finally discontentment. To me, it completely tracks. I don't think Csikszentmihalyi is even aware of it, but it completely attracts. And then Steele uses the term suitable calling, which I think is flow. Suitable calling. I want to come back to the progression of economic value. Not all of you should be teachers. Certainly the people to whom you minister. And I'd like to see a lot more Christians participate in the marketplace with experiences and transformations. I don't want to see the visible church be a business, but rather have the visible church send forth many into the marketplace to start enterprises in this sphere. And to show you what's possible here and the kinds of businesses I'm talking about, let me share with you, as my last sort of riff here, 8 experience-based startups that have contacted my firm, Strategic Horizons, in the past few years. They're either seeking capital or advice. And I've got permission. I've only presented this one other time at a design conference, so you're the second time through. I pulled this off the shelf because I thought it would be useful for you to see the kinds of things that are emerging in business. And I think I've got some, I don't know these companies that well, so I've got some little fact cards here, so let me go through some of the key factoids for these businesses. First, Scratch Handicap Reduction Programs, UK company. If you want to check out their existing experience called Top Golf, it's basically a reinvented driving range experience where every ball is a microchip in the ball, and they know where they land. They give you buckets, so they score every bucket of balls you hit. It's like a karaoke bar for like a driving range. Well, they're coming up. That's their experience. They're going to go into the transformation realm. Scratch Handicap, the basic idea is to charge explicitly for handicap reduction. To charge explicitly a measurable improvement in self, in the handicap, and to not charge for a lesson, time, but rather charge only for the demonstrated outcome, the change. That company emerging in the golf industry. Spiffy Wardrobe Rotation Management. Okay. You pay an annual fee. They're responsible for agreed-upon portfolio of garments and a turnover replacement frequency, highly customized pricing. They'll basically come to your home and analyze your closet. And I saw a very interesting analysis they've done about the percentage of clothes that are purchased and either once worn or never worn. So they talk about the economics of both more efficiently buying clothing, also making sure you're always in style. Right? So they'll subsume the dry cleaner inside this offering. You basically pay annual and a monthly fee for a set list of clothing, and you pay them to manage the way you look in your clothing. ShareaChef. This grew out of a study by the U.S. Personal Chef Association, founded in 1992, yada, yada. A couple of consultants launching. Here's some interesting factoids. There are 5,000 dedicated personal or private chefs. There's 5,000 people in the United States can afford to have their own full-time chef. In the last 5 years, if you followed this, last 5 years, 2,000 food preparation centers have opened. Those are people not going to a grocery store, but instead going to a food preparation center, and at the center working with a chef to do all meal preparation for a week. Right? It's a high-growth sector in the food industry. Well, this is the notion of a chef coming to your home. They've basically done the analysis that basically if 10 families will go in on one chef, the chef can visit each home to the home once a week instead of you going to them, early and late shift in the dinner hour, and do all the meal preparation for a week with a quality chef. So it's like a time sharing of a chef. And very interesting statistics about the salaries of executive chefs and line chefs and the hours they work. So part of this is going to be very attractive to chefs. Work less hours, get higher pay. And again, I won't share all the economics, but very interesting enterprise. I love this one, Toy Nanny. It's like the Netflix of toys. Kids have too many toys. Right? People in churches, they're overflowing with too many toys. Parents, relatives, grandparents, buying too many toys. Toys aren't properly rotated for child development and so forth. So again, it's a Canadian firm. Basically, will pay for toy rotation. from newborn to 7 years of old. That's how they're going to start. A little plug-and-play container system I've seen, very interesting looking. It's giftable. Like for less than $100 a month, you can give this to somebody as a gift. So that's Toy Nanny. I got to speed this up with my time here. Ink. I'll just do this real quickly. This is based on the movie Sliding Doors. And they got statistics on that 7,500 members of the Writers Guild of America, only 2,000 any given year are actually employed. There's 320 freelance writers. This is a basic notion of basically they will write a screenplay of your life based on a moment. They'll interview you based on a moment in time. You could have done this or you could have done that. Right? Dave Matthews' lyric, could have been a parking attendant, could have, which way you go? They'll write a screenplay, and then the one screenplay a year they'll put into actual production to have a movie. Okay, the price tag of this, by the way, is between $10,000 and $20,000, right? But it's going to be offered. Here's one of my favorites. It pretty much speaks for itself. Video in cab and externally. You have to take a class to learn how to operate the 18-wheeler. It goes down a hill and then up the gravel, and you come away with a video of your actual runaway truck experience. How cool is that? I know you're going to go to their website as soon as we get done here, aren't you? Walden Vacation Club, 24 people, 2 weeks fractional ownership. You go and you build your dwelling. It's a really amazing timeshare. Build a dwelling, then you'll return for 2 weeks of solitude in the building that you then, and for the other 4 weeks, will be open for people to come communally to meet the other people that you shared this experience. This is like Habitat for Humanity meets Marriott Vacation Club or something. And then one more, Whole Health. Whole Health is basically transformations, 5 indicators of wellness. Good, bad cholesterol, heart rate, blood pressure, weight, body fat, charging explicitly for the sustained reduction of those measurements of wellness. So I'll give you a sampling of the kind of things that are emerging. So let's just do cheering, just which one of these would you most want to purchase yourself, okay? When I was with designers, I had them vote for which one they'd like to go work for. But Scratch, how many of you would go, again, cheering if you want it. Okay, our golfers in the crowd. Spiffy wardrobe management. Okay. Those of you clapping, you look like you could use it. Share a Chef. Oh, yeah, good, okay. Toy Nanny. All right, I think so far Share a Chef. Ink. Runaway Truck Experience. Oh, yeah. Awesome. Too bad it's only ever going to be a $2 million business, but maybe it'll double that with you all. Walden Club, Vacation Club? It's all anticlimactic now, isn't it? Whole Health? Okay, here's the key thing about all these. All inexperiences are fake. I made them up. I know. I made them up on one flight from Cleveland to Dallas. All the logos I stole images on Google. Bad news for graphic designers. They're all fake. Here's how I came up with them. Every single one of these business concepts I thought of by thinking about a different genre of reality television. Scratch is Dr. 90210 meets Daily Planet. Spiffy Wardrobe Management, that's Ambush Makeover. Share a Chef, Iron Chef. Toy Nanny, Nanny 911. Real World for Inc. Runaway Truck Experience, tell me if that is not Fear Factor. Survivor. And then for Whole Health, The Biggest Loser. Here's my point. Every genre or subgenre of reality television on the air today represents a distinct category of experience and transformation that I believe we're going to see emerge in the world of commerce. It's happening already. Fifth Wheel, Blind Date, et al., Match.com, eHarmony. Right, I could go on all these things. It's happening. Right, although the tourism is becoming more and more like The Amazing Race. Right, I mean, it's happening. Right, you want to understand what's happening, look at the marketplace. Because these are human needs, just as legitimate needs being met by goods and services being fulfilled through experiences and transformations. I'll talk more about reality television, or at least authenticity, in my time with you tomorrow. I will share this for now, is in writing this book, Authenticity, I have had to watch more than my fair share of reality television. It was tough to do, but I spent some time. And my favorite show, reality TV show, is without a doubt The Bachelor. Thank you. One honest person. One honest person. I can do 4D models on, by the way, I can do the 4D model on The Bachelor. Highly educational, right? Dudes, you can learn like how to date from this show, right? What works, what doesn't. And particularly women, there's always a woman who's attractive enough that she never gets cut the first week, but she comes on too strong and she's always cut in episode 2, right? Wonderfully educational, right? Entertaining, I can go on and on. The very first season of The Bachelor, the very last episode when the Bachelor, Alex, who I swear was a McKinsey consultant, he just had all the behavioral characteristics of a McKinsey guy. He was down to the two last women he was dating, and he was on his final date with Amanda, the woman to whom he finally presented the final rose. And they're in the hot tub on their final date, and Amanda turns to Alex, and she says to Alex, I'm watching this with my wife. Yes, it's our date night. We love it. Amanda turns to Alex and says, I can't wait to get back to real reality. We're like, what? Did I hear what I heard? Yes, real reality. We live in a time where we qualify the term reality with the adjective real. It's because in a world that's increasingly staged, mediated, and paid for, people long for real. I'll return to that theme tomorrow. For now, I've titled my talk, Fear and Trembling, Experience Economy. When I first heard of Acts 29, I was reminded of this book I have from my high school years, Malcolm Muggeridge's A Third Testament, because the Third Testament to me is so like Acts 29. A book that Malcolm Muggeridge did a BBC series on and then wrote this book. First, I'm going to read what Muggeridge says about Soren Kierkegaard, and then I'm going to read some actual quotes of Kierkegaard. A person who Muggeridge describes as, and I love this, when I read this in high school, I determined to make this my resume. He's given to roaming the streets. Me too. I just love being on the street. Walking is like the best experience. An uncannily accurate prophet. Some of his quotes, you'll see that that's the case. And I love this one. Forecasts based purely on his imaginative intuition. Cantankerous. My wife will tell you that's a great adjective for me. And a Christian auditor. I'll come back to the Christian auditor in a moment. Here's what Muggeridge has to say in the Third Testament about Kierkegaard. He writes about those who see deeply into the nature of life are able to project this knowledge into the future, and so in some degree to foretell it. Thus we find Kierkegaard again and again diagnosing with uncanny precision the ills that would befall a materialistic society, especially when Christianity, the only possible corrective, partook of the same spirit, so that not only did science insist that men could live by bread alone, but the spirit of Christ was invoked to say that they should. Does that not also characterize our time? You can fill in science for anything postmodern you like, but it's the same thing. Now, here's some words of Kierkegaard, the uncanny precision of his predictions. More than 200 years ago, he wrote, suppose someone invented an instrument, a convenient talking tube, which, say, could be heard all over the land. Muggeridge thought this was television. Internet comes to mind, of course. Then Kierkegaard writes, I wonder if the police would not forbid it, fearing that the whole country would become mentally deranged if it were used. Kierkegaard described himself not as an apostle, but as a Christian auditor. because he said, quote, an apostle proclaims the truth, an auditor is responsible for discovering counterfeits. We need more Christian auditors today. The counterfeits abound. And then two more quotes. Kierkegaard hated the newspaper. He wrote this, on the whole, the evil in the daily press consists in its being calculated to make, if possible, the passing moment 1,000 or 10,000 times more inflated and important than it really is. But all moral elevation consists first and foremost in being weaned from the momentary. There has never been a power so diametrically opposed to Christianity as the daily press. What would he think of Google? Day in and day out, the daily press does nothing but delude men with the supreme axiom of this lie, that numbers are decisive. Christianity, on the other hand, is based on the thought that the truth lies in the single individual. Last quote. Christianity implies unconditionally that every man, every single individual is uniquely close to God. How close and equally close? Not in terms of distance, but how? How close? How equally close? Because loved by him. Consequently, there is equality, the equality of infinity between man and man. If there is a distinction, it is that one person bears in mind that he is loved, perhaps day after day, perhaps day after day for 70 years, perhaps with only one longing, a longing for eternity, so that he really can grasp this thought and go through life with it, concerning himself with the blessed occupation of meditating on how he is loved, and not, alas, because of his own virtue. Another person, perhaps, does not remember that he is loved. Perhaps it goes on year after year, day after day, as does not think of his being loved. Or perhaps he is glad and grateful to be loved by his wife, by his children, by his friends, by his contemporaries, but he does not think of his being loved by God. Or perhaps he laments not having been loved by anyone and does not think of being loved by God. Infinite divine love which makes no distinction. Yes, but what of human ingratitude? If there is an equality among us men in which we completely resemble each other, it is that not one of us truly thinks about being loved. My prayer is that you would think constantly of being loved and help those who God loves and be his servant to help him draw them to our Lord. Thank you very much for your time. I'll see you again tomorrow. Thank you very much.